Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We meet around our kitchen table here once a week at the studios of KHOI Community Radio. And we talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more at their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
It is nice to have a place to come every week. We do this show live. We do this show live without a net, so you never know what's going to happen here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, today, I know we always pretend we're sitting around the kitchen table,
right, right.
But now we've got the wood stove burning
in
our imagination.
Oh, yeah, we do. Crackle,
it,
crackle.
It is time, sparks, time for the wood stove.
Here, in middle of October, we got an official frost. At least I'm calling it an official frost.
And we had snow.
We had snow. I saw my first snowman in West Ames.
I didn't think we had that much snow.
I didn't either. I didn't stop to poke at it and see if they kind of just packed the snow around something else. But I suppose when it was really coming down, if they went up and down the sidewalks, they probably could have. It was an impressive little guy. He was there, and it was good. So, first snowman, and snow.
And this is before the leaves have fallen. This is not coming in the proper sequence.
It is not the proper sequence at all. And to further confuse things, I was listening to this fine community radio station this morning, and what do I hear? But music from the Nutcracker. It was the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. And I thought, oh, my goodness, is it that
time already?
Is it that time?
Oh, my goodness.
For many years, when I heard this when I was younger, I was sure it wasn't Sugar Plum Fairy. But considering it was Christmas and everybody was in the
mood. Are we supposed to have the night on Bald Mountain before the Sugar Plum Fairies?
Well, no, it wasn't quite in the right order. But I always thought the Sugar Plum Fairy was not the Plum Fairy, but the Plump Fairy, the Sugar Plump Fairy, because, it's Christmas and you're eating all these good things, Sugar Plump Fairy. So I kind of like to think of that. So anyway, I didn't mind hearing. I love that music. But yes, it's coming. There's the Nutcracker in there. And also, Donna, did you ever wonder, is a Nutcracker really the sort of gift you'd give to a young girl? I mean, That's the gift that was given by.
I know. Yeah. I think it's like the introduction of the patriarchy to the young females.
I think we should have a whole show on this. Yes.
Oh, we could do a whole year on this one, Lana. Or maybe let's go over our whole lifetimes.
Starting with the Sugar Plump Fairy and going on. Anyway, so we did get snow, but it's sunshiny today, and last week we had a encore presentation because I wasn't here. Last week, I seldom take a vacation, but my husband and I went to Wisconsin, and we just decided to take a little time off. A friend said, here, why don't you just go up to our cabin for a while, and we'll just, it was so lovely.
A cabin in the woods on the lake. Yeah.
It was.
Oh,
it was,
boy.
Now,
good
it did,
for you.
It did snow there. The first day was quite cold, but it warmed up. It spritz of rain here and there, but it warmed up. The sun came out, and I have never, I've been around the sun quite a few times. I've never seen prettier trees up there. I hit the colors.
Well, and you're a Wisconsin native.
Right,
so.
And I thought, well, it never was this pretty before. Maybe it's because I've been away for a while. But
have you had your cataracts removed or something?
Not yet. That's next week there. Okay.
Okay.
But the maples and the birches and the oaks and the poplars, everything was quite lovely. I ran across and got some advice on where to go. Of course, a lot of little towns up there, kind of northeast of Eau Claire, about kind of in middle central north middle of Wisconsin.
Up there.
And there was this fun little town called Weyerhaeuser, like the paper manufacturer. But it's teeny tiny, a couple hundred people there. But I was told about this town. It's worth a trip. They have a meat market there, believe it or not, a place called Barney's Meats. And since this is a kitchen show, I wanted to mention Barney's Meats.
It's like a butchery, or
they have a butcher shop, a small grocery store, not unlike the Slater grocery store in a little town south of it. Just a small grocery store, everything you need, but not very.
Well, I hate to ask this, but is this like the new Fairway Meat Market that's now on the west side of town?
It's kind of the old
version of it.
Yeah, they have never changed. Because, of course, it's to a lot of tourists there in the summertime, a lot of hunters. So as you go in the door, we process venison and bear. So,
they're like breaking it down, making and sausages.
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. And I got the best summer sausage there. It was lovely, and some good Braunschweiger. If you're ever clear up in the Northwoods, Barney's Meats in Weyerhaeuser, Wisconsin. Thanks to Cousin Dave and Cousin Dana for kind of pointing me in that direction. I wouldn't have gone to that little teeny tiny town, but there it was.
I suppose it's local meats, local bear, local venison.
Well, I don't think you ship in bear from other places.
Well, thank goodness it hasn't come to that.
Oh, dear. Anyway, bear and things. And also, what was going on, I also visited family in southern Wisconsin, and I hit it again this year. My hometown has a... called Reedsburg, Wisconsin, has a festival this time of year. Actually, it goes over 2 weekends and lots of hoopla goes on. It's called the Fermentation Festival, and it's put on by an organization called the Worm Farm Institute. They're kind of a version of, they're like ag arts. Ag arts in Iowa mixes agriculture and arts, and
they go together, don't they?
And the Worm Farm Institute sort of does that too. Mm-hmm. They have classes up the kazoo. Anything about it? This has grown. This is the eighth annual Worm Farm.
All right, so this was not going on when you were growing up.
No.
You didn't grow up in a hotbed of counterculture.
No, I didn't. I think these folks moved in from someplace else, but they were welcome, and things are going well. There were over 50 classes that you had to sign up for ahead of time. I didn't get any. But how to make cheese, how to ferment things, how to forage in rural Wisconsin, things about chocolate, cider, beer, cheese making, vinegar, sourdough breads, beer and chocolate pairings, vegetable fermentation, hot
this
sauce.
This is an awful lot of chocolate.
Yeah.
What are they taking up, chocolate growing in Wisconsin?
No, it's a fermentation thing. They have speakers come in. I think the speaker was a chocolate guy. Anyway, visiting cheese factories and all kinds. Anyway, Fermentation Fest. Three cheers to those folks. For more information, go to fermentationfest.com. It's put on by the Worm Farm Institute. It's a thing to celebrate. Lots of stuff going on. And I think it will happen next year, too. Although it was quite rainy up there. They had more rain there than we did, and there were puddles, and the Baraboo River and the Wisconsin River were out of their banks. And, was just something. Anyway. So that was my trip to Wisconsin. And, yes, the trees were lovely. We had a good time. Back home. Besides the snow, it's the time of year I'm putting the garden to bed and moving plants around, and some plants inside, the other ones are just left to their fate out in the garden, and I kind of see to the compost pile and move that out and turn it around and put the compost where I want it to be for next year. It's also a good time to organize and label seeds that I have been saving. You know, you just can't leave them on a plate or in an envelope and not label them.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I'll remember in six months.
Sure, sure. No.
How about 5 minutes?
Oh, my. And even, so I've been better and better each year about actually writing it out and put the year on it, for goodness sakes. You never know. Yes. And you and I talked about this earlier, Donna, rooting things. There's a plant out there.
Yes, of course. When I looked out the window and saw that it was snowing, I thought, I better go out and get in my rose geraniums and my lemon verbena, because those things have to come in. So now Lana is the one who has always taken my little cuttings off the rose geraniums and made them grow because I haven't been very good at it. But now I've been given some instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I bought the powder. Rutone
is a little white powder that you dip the ends of the cuttings in.
Dip them in the powder, right in the jar?
Right in the jar.
And then stick the whole thing in water?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because rose geraniums, in fact, all scented geraniums, are not real geraniums. Yeah. They're in some other family, and I can spout a real geranium, but these guys are a little bit, I guess they're woodier or something, but they're a little bit more difficult, and we do love a good rose geranium. We're propagating them and putting them all over town.
That we are, and they do take I don't have luck rooting everything. You know, about half of the rooting things that I try work, and those that don't, well, they go on the compost pile.
Oh, but I have another question. Right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So at the same time as bringing in the plants, I was also out clipping every last thing. Like now, I'm drawing some lemon verbena leaves. And I'm drying some lovage leaves. I've already dried all the basil and gotten that in jars. Now, I was able to grow a lot of shiso because it kind of drops seeds and comes back. And every year, like, I have oceans of shiso, which I love. I don't know if it would dry. I should try
drawing some of it. It seems like it would be like basil, not as strong as, but.
I mean, one year I put it in vodka and it was ever so lovely.
That's a good way to do it. This year
I want to make jelly. So you said to get apple juice. So I picked a bunch of shiso and I made a very strong tea and it's in the fridge. Now I have to go, what kind of apple juice should I get?
Make sure that it doesn't have, it just says apple juice. Like there's no preservatives or strange things added like corn syrup. Or you got to read the labels.
Okay.
Just 100% apple juice.
And it should it be the clear, unfiltered kind?
It'd be prettier.
Prettier jelly?
Yeah, yeah. I have tried, you know, grab kind of a run-of-the-mill apple juice to try something. And if it's got other additives, then you got to watch that.
Most of the, like, organic, cold-pressed is a little bit cloudy. So, like, I should just go get some of, like, the normal, like, Martinelli's kind of.
Just something off
the
shelf.
Well, maybe I could get an organic one and just super filter it or something for cheesecloth.
It's all right to have it a little cloudy.
Because
good luck.
I tried to make a batch last week and it tasted so good by the time I got the shiso and the apple juice. I just started drinking it. So I thought, oh boy, I got to make another batch.
This is a good topic for a show. We should continue talking here.
Well, wait till I've done it successfully.
Okay.
We'll see.
We're going to talk about more fall flavors today. There's lots of fall stuff going on, and we're kind of thinking of, oh, my goodness, the garden produced this and that and put a little by for winter. Donna, you ran across a good book. Tell us about that good book.
Oh, yeah. While Lana was in Wisconsin, I went to Minnesota.
Ah.
So I had a little road trip up there, and I want you guys to know that even though it's north of us, their leaves are not any yellower and redder than ours are at the moment. So I had the good fortune to go to the Louise Erdrich bookstore, the name of which I have forgotten right now, but it's quite a charming little place. And I found a book called In Winter's Kitchen, Growing Roots and Breaking Bread in the Northern Heartland. So it was just it popped off the shelf because it's the mood and the time where we are right now. So it's written by Beth Dooley, who is a well-known food writer in the Minneapolis area. And she writes the chapters. This is where we are right now. There's an apple chapter, a wheat chapter, potatoes, beans and carrots, sweet potatoes, cranberries, a chestnut chapter, which I thought was very thorough. She has a good history of, you know, how we lost our chestnut trees and how they're coming back and that kind of stuff that I sort of vaguely knew but wasn't precisely into my brain. Birch Bark Bookstore. There you go. So let's see. After chestnuts is The corn chapter, the milk chapter, the cheese and butter chapter, the turkey chapter, and the wild rice chapter.
Oh, yeah, you were in Minnesota. Isn't that wild rice?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Good.
But, you know, this is, I mean, yeah, we don't grow wild rice down here, but the rest of the stuff does apply. So I was just reading, so I went straight to the cheese and butter chapter, right? I'm going to read you just a tiny little bit because she does some good historical things. She had already done wheat and talked about, you know, how it had been imported, especially the Turkish red and certain varieties that had done very well here in the Northlands and then, of course,
in the Midwest.
Absolutely.
Sure, sure.
So it says in the mid-1800s, when overplanting left wheat vulnerable to blight, the depleted fields of southern Wisconsin were converted to grass pastures for dairy cattle. Before that, cheese making had been the domain of farm women whose, quote, cheese and egg money paid for small household luxuries like sugar and ribbons. But when the wheat crops failed, dairy products became many farmers' primary income. By the early 1900s, Wisconsin was the home to some 1,500 cheese plants located at rural crossroads. Milk processing moved off the farms as farmers formed large cooperative dairies. The nation's first, the Land O'Lakes, was founded in 1921 as the Minnesota Cooperative Creamers Association. It has grown from 320 dairymen to 32,000 members nationwide. Also up there, which is still a co-op, though, is the home of Organic Valley.
Right.
Which started as a dairy cooperative and is still, it's certainly the largest organic cooperative. And so I have to say, when you're shopping for organic milk, aside from, of course, all our favorite local producers, but if you're in some place that only has the major national brands, just remember that Organic Valley is still family farmers sold cooperative as opposed to like Horizon and other brands. It's still organic, but Organic Valley is still small family farms, real farmers.
And that co-op started and I think is still centered in Viroqua, Wisconsin.
It is.
Kind of over, it's kind of in the lower left-hand corner.
Yeah, they do have, you know, New England Organic Valley cooperatives and California, of course, where this is because, of course, California has usurped Wisconsin as the dairy state.
Ah, well, they can usurp. They get a lot of people to drink
milk
out there,
too. Yeah, we have a few more
too.
Droughts out there, and it'll be back all moving back to Wisconsin, right?
Well, also, people drink milk and eat vegetables all over the place. This idea of being the best and being the biggest, I think it's a little dangerous. I'm the biggest. The biggest election crowd day rally ever, huh?
Oh,
you know, the biggest is not, who cares? Just so it's good.
Want it to be the best.
The
it's
best is good.
The best
is good. And I did, maybe you've heard of this. I went to a place that has been making cheese in Wisconsin since way before I was a little bitty girl, because I remember going there with my grandmother. It's Carr Valley Cheese, and that's up in kind of my hometown, like in the lower left-hand corner of Wisconsin. And Carr Valley Cheese, C-A-R-R Valley.
And they're still making good cheese.
They're still making great cheese. And they've expanded into not just your usual kind of, you know, just cheddars and the Swisses, but they are playing around with goat cheese, and their sheep cheese is just really, really lots of different kinds to choose from. And
I was looking at the cheese counter at one of the co-ops up in Minneapolis, and there are some good ones up there, of course. And the amount of sheep and goat, because, of course, I said, what's local here? What's regional? Mm-hmm. What do you got that maybe I haven't tasted in Iowa? And the I have never milked a sheep, I have to say.
I haven't either. But I'm getting to know some sheep. We're grazing some sheep for meat, not.
Yeah, those are not dairy.
No,
sheep,
they're not dairy. But I could, you know, they're a little less imposing than your big Holstein there.
No, I mean, I've been to a number of milking goat farms, and it's absolutely so much fun. I would love to see a sheep milking farm, though.
Yeah. There's some around because they're making sheep milk.
They certainly are. So this book, aptly titled for the season at hand, In Winter's Kitchen by Beth Dooley. It's a lovely little read.
Good. And it's not so much a recipe book as history and stories.
No, it's not really recipes. It's a lot of kind of how it happened, how we arrived at these sorts of things. I haven't even finished it. I'm looking forward to the wild rice. Oh, there are a few. Oh, yeah. Well, she gets into, like, simply roast turkey and what are the best mashed potatoes, but not much. Mm-hmm. It's really about where the food comes from.
Ah. Well, something else I've been doing, kind of as the summer comes to the end, is ground cherries. Ground cherries. I have been picking ground cherries, and I have been making ground cherry jam.
All right. You better elaborate on what a ground cherry is. It's a little esoteric.
The ground cherry is no relation to a cherry, but a member of the nightshade family. Think of it like a teeny tiny tomatillo. It's on a low vine.
Is it related to a tomatillo?
It's in the nightshade, which means it's a tomato family.
Well, I mean, it looks, you know, because they have that papery covering around them, but it doesn't taste. It's so sweet and delicious.
Yeah, it's very, very sweet. You have to wait till they ripen. Mm-hmm. It's also called, I mean, this is not very, it doesn't taste very good. It doesn't sound like it'd be very good. It's called the bladder cherry because of that.
Oh, the paper around it?
The husk cherry, the strawberry tomato.
Husk cherry, I think I've heard.
Or the dwarf Cape gooseberry, but it's not a gooseberry.
I've heard that name, too.
The Latin name is Physalis pubescens, so let that roll off your tongue a little bit. And it is... It grows wild, actually, here in Iowa, but I plant them in the garden because... You need quite a handful of them to make anything out of, and I'm not going to be crawling through the prairie.
Oh, yeah, they're not very – they're like the size of a nickel, more or less.
Yeah. Then it takes a while to get – yeah.
Now, don't we have a recipe on our website, Sharon Rasmussen's ground cherry pie?
Yeah, Grandmother Kneff's, which is Mark Rasmussen's grandmother – as I recall.
No, I think it's Sharon's.
Grandmother. It's on our website. And, yes, it's a ground cherry pie. Ha! And it's good. Now, ground cherries taste probably like nothing else. But I've talked about it with my friend
Sue. It's lovely, right?
Yeah. And my friend Sue and I came up with this. It tastes like if you blended pineapple and apricots together. Huh?
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't taste like tomatoes. It doesn't taste like cherries. It's kind of got this apricot-y something to it. Yeah, it does. It grows on a sprawling plant. Its seedling is over a foot high.
And it's kind of light yellow when it's ripe.
And these little husks come out.
It's subtle, though.
Yeah, very subtle. Very subtle.
It's very subtle.
And you can pick these little like Chinese lantern. It is related to the Chinese lantern. That's an ornamental, though. Little papery five-sided husks. They get whiter and whiter as they're ready. They drop on the ground. I pick them off of the ground. I usually mulch underneath things so it stays nice and clean. And what is so nice about these things, you can pick them and let them ripen. They're only good when you ripen them. If you bite into a green one, forget it.
So it's like a tomato in that you pick them and just let them sit there till they're ready.
Yes, yes. Okay. I got my information from Yule Gibbons's Stalking the Wild Asparagus, and he says, when husks are thoroughly dry, the fruit can be stored in a dry place, and they will keep for a month or so. Hmm. They dry on a piece of – I just dump them out on a chunk of paper, of newspaper, and let them – And as soon as you pop them open, and this is a good thing to watch, watch a movie or watch something on PBS and spend the evening popping the insides out and getting a bowl
full.
Well,
they're a lot easier than picking nuts or something that. They're not that difficult.
So you end up with a bowl of little gold
things.
Yeah,
and you pop a few in your mouth the way.
And
so what are you doing? Making them into jelly?
Ground cherry jam. Jam because you use the whole ground cherry, and it does have a skin, and it's got little here it'll start looking like a tomato. It's got teeny, teeny, yes. tiny little tomato seeds, and that's part of the charm. The jam ends up having this little teeny,
right, so
tiny
once you
seeds.
Take the papers off of them, you just throw them right in the pot.
The
There's
whole
no
thing.
Further. You don't have
the
to,
whole thing.
You don't have to do anything.
And
like
ground
cut
cherries
them up
don't have thorns like raspberry. Yeah, I like ground cherries. Here is the recipe for ground cherry jam. Crush 1 quart of husked ground cherries and add the juice of 2 lemons, the grated peel of 1 lemon, 1/2 cup water, and 1 package of powdered pectin. Stir. Boil for 5 minutes and add 4 cups sugar. Now, after it's broken down, before I add the sugar, I use a immersion blender to kind of smoosh them up.
Oh, that's a
Instead
good idea.
Instead of just crushing them.
So it gives it a more even consistency.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So stir, boil for 5 minutes, and then add 4 cups of sugar and 1 package of pectin. And there you go.
Wait, the pectin goes in with the sugar?
No, the pectin goes in at the beginning with ground cherries.
Oh, okay.
So everything together, boil by boil, and then add the sugar. If you bring it to the boil once, add the sugar, bring it to the boil again, and then... Then you can kind of use your spoon to see if it's thickening a little bit. Pour into jelly jars and seal. Huh, that's from the recipe from Stalking the Wild Asparagus by Yule Gibbons. Yes,
right.
It is.
They have such a subtle flavor.
Yeah.
You really don't want to put much with them because you could cover that flavor. And then what would be the point?
What would be the point? Ground cherry jam. And it's that late season. They're frozen now. But... It's a late season good thing from the garden. You're listening to KHOI, and this is Community Radio, and the Donalana Kitchen is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We're talking about fall recipes. We're sitting here, getting a little cold outside and getting out the warm sweaters and figuring out just where the heck you did put those pair of gloves last fall or last spring and finding all that warm stuff. And good food kind of fits into this. We have news items every now and then here in the Donalana Kitchen. Our news department is always hot on the trail of what's new in the food scene, and Donna has something for us to to share today. So, from the Donalana Kitchen News Department, tick-a-tick-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick-a-tick, that's the ticker tape.
All right.
Take it away,
Donna.
I hate
to say this is news, okay?
This is not
because
news.
If this is news, then I'm a prophetic voice from 30 years ago. This is about artificial sweeteners. Uh-huh. Now, I have spent my life avoiding artificial sweeteners, right? Because why? Obviously was not scientifically established until fairly recently. So, this is an article, What Artificial Sweeteners Do to Your Health. It's just from Mother Earth News. They do a lot of compilations, but, so they're quoting a 2018 study and a 2014 study, and, a 2014 scientific study suggests the reason artificial sweeteners may be a factor in diabetes, right? Because, of course, if you're diabetic, what have you been eating? Artificial sweeteners, right? Is that even though they don't contain sugar, it's because they mess with the gut bacteria.
Ah, the gut bacteria. Yes, there we are again.
So now, finally, as we are exploring the microbiome, we realize that saccharin, aspartame, and sucralose can help you develop glucose intolerance. And also the other recent studies, and this has been in the news quite a bit lately, apparently Diet Coke and other diet beverages do not help you lose weight. They actually can change your metabolism in a way that's very unfavorable, which does not mean you should run out and drink sodas with real sugar. How about water?
Yeah.
Right? So all of these artificial sweeteners that one of the headlines, do artificial sweeteners make us fat? Hello.
As opposed to those plaid pants, yes. Yeah, wait, same thing.
Okay. It says many health-conscious individuals like to consume low-calorie sweeteners as an alternative to sugar. However, there is increasing scientific evidence that these sweeteners promote metabolic dysfunction. Now, golly, what do you think about metabolic dysfunction?
Yeah, not good.
Yeah. I'll have a little honey with my tea or something like that. Now, the one thing that is not included in this is stevia.
Oh.
And most of the products that are predominantly stevia, because stevia leaf is a natural, it's a plant. It's a plant. And if you've ever eaten a stevia leaf, you will notice that it is sweet.
I've actually grown that at the Stevia,
uh-huh.
And I can't say I had a great luck with it as a plant, but yes, you break it off, and the leaves are just unbelievably sweet.
Yeah. And some stevia products, and you need to make sure that that's really all that's in there and there's not some other artificial sweeteners, some taste better than others. That's all I'm going to say about that.
All right.
Okay.
A voice from the kitchen.
Some of them I can, you know, I don't know. Like when I'm doing an event and, and I have to put out coffee and tea, I don't put out, of course, the little pink packets of whatever those things are. I will put out the little packets of stevia.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
So just don't eat that stuff. Okay.
Right. A little news.
Yeah. It's not news. I don't know. Did you ever eat that, Lana?
No.
Me either.
Unfortunately, I like regular sugar too much.
Well,
but yeah, it's true. And here's a note. We're kind of moving up to Halloween, you see? And lots of candy.
Candy.
Yeah,
here we go.
So just keep that kind of in the back of your mind. Artificial sweeteners, maybe not so much.
Okay. Yeah, I think last year I handed out apples.
Oh, yeah. You're one of those old ladies on the block.
I am. And, you know, the kids, they see that apple and some of them, the younger ones are usually pretty good. The older ones are just kind of, you can see their face falls flat and they don't take seconds and thirds either.
Oh, well, that's all right. That's all right. On to the next then. They can just go trick or treating.
Did you know one year, I don't know if Helen is doing this year, but Helen Gunderson did a thing one year. She planted a special carrot patch for Halloween. So when the kids came, she took them out and they each each dug their own carrot. How's that for a treat?
That's good. And it's even Halloween orange. Good job.
That's right.
Good job. I kind of ran across, we're talking food here, I ran across a little bit about the history and pepper. We think of black, we're not talking sweet peppers or hot peppers that grow on, and not the nightshades.
We're going into the spicy.
This is the peppercorn, and we add this sort of things to soups and stews and just about everything. You find pepper, black pepper on more stuff now. People used to kind of be a little shy when it came to seasoning.
You know, I always put black pepper, a little black pepper in a lot of my sweets. Like my biscotti recipe always has a pinch of black pepper. Not enough that you want to taste it and go, oh, it's got black pepper in it. But just enough to like, it's like a little tickle.
It is. Tickling,
perks it up a little bit.
I read a little bit here from a book called The Food Lover's Companion, Comprehensive Definitions of Nearly 6,000 Food, Drinks, and Culinary Terms.
It is a very good book. Before the advent of spell check, I kept the Food Lover's Companion on my desk to look up to make sure that I had spelled some of these things properly.
Yes.
Everything is in there.
It is. Peppercorn, it says. Most cooks today don't appreciate this spice. It was once so valuable and rare, it was sometimes used as currency. Its merit was so high that many of the European sailing expeditions during the 15th century were undertaken with the main purpose of finding alternate trade routes to the Far East. Why? The prized peppercorn.
A spice route.
Because it, and not just for the taste at all in itself, but it stimulates the gastric juices. It delivers a digestive bonus. The world's most popular spice is a berry that grows in grape-like clusters on the pepper plant Piper nigrum. Yeah. A climbing vine native to India and Indonesia, the berry is processed to produce three basic types of peppercorn, the most common black peppercorn. It's not quite ripe, but it's kind of dried and shrivels. And the best black peppers are the Telecherry and the Lampung black peppers. And I don't remember which one. One of those is the wrong size for my pepper meal. I can never remember which one.
Well, the Telecherry is more what we're used to in the
Western
palate.
I was trying something new, and it didn't fit through my anyway. The less pungent is the white peppercorn. And the white pepper.
Yeah, you either love it or you don't. Sometimes I think it tastes like pig belly or something, you know. I mean, it has a pungent flavor to it.
That's after it's allowed to ripen. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And it does turn grayish, whitish. People, you've run across it in recipes. Say, oh, you don't want sprinkles of black pepper in this. This is a white dish.
People do it for color, but it has a completely different flavor.
It kind of tastes musty, dusty to me, but it's interesting. Then the green peppercorn is the soft, unripe berry, huh?
Different. It also has a different flavor. It's lovely and more has more uses than the white. Now, there's also the pink peppercorn.
Oh, really?
Which is a completely, it's not in the same family, but it does grow, like even in Southern California and on down into Baja, Mexico, there are a lot of pepper trees. And pink. And they're lovely. I like to cook with it. Now, I have a little trick. For fresh peppercorns, right? People do use, of course, you know, pepper is best if it's freshly grated. It really, the oils in it break down quickly after you've done that. So, like, the pepper that you buy that's already ground in the store doesn't have a lot of flavor left. So, I, of course, have a grater, which I use a great deal. However, when I'm cooking a lot and I need a good amount of pepper, you know, I like a lot of black pepper in my food. I put a bunch of it in the coffee grinder and just grind it up really fine. And then I have a little jar of it sitting there that I know is relatively freshly ground. And that's a very easy way of dealing with it.
It does make a difference.
Yep.
It does. I mentioned that, you know, the sailing ships went off in search of pepper, and actually, okay, get this. In 408 AD, Oof. We're back here with the Visigoths, and they were attacking Rome, and they had Rome under siege. And they finally decided to let them off if Rome paid them a quantity of gold and a large quantity of black pepper. So, they must have been important then.
Well, they say, the food historians say, that one of the reasons that the spice trade was so important is because, of course, they didn't have really good preservation techniques for a lot of foods. So spices were used bountifully to cover other more off flavors. And salt is the other thing that, of course, was traded just like it was money, because places that were not near the ocean often didn't have salt.
Just think of that. See, food is important. Well, still today, I mean,
food is still important.
Places in Africa, they mine salt. And I saw a picture someplace, chunks of salt on the back of these long-suffering camels going from oasis to oasis across the Sahara. Oh, my goodness. Salt and pepper. Here's another interesting historic item here. According to the English, pepper's always been important. Every legal contract requires that each party give something of value to the other. So to make it a contract. And so maybe you didn't want to do it money. You're just trading. But to make it legal, they have to exchange something of value. And so there's a term called peppercorn rent. As in, okay, I'm just going to give you this, but to make it legal on paper, here is a handful of peppercorns to make it legal. That's pretty good, huh?
So I'm assuming peppercorns, they're tropical.
Well,
that's why we had to trade for
India,
them, right?
Indonesia, yeah. I would assume, okay. A vine growing. So the price, actually during the mid-16th century, the price of pepper served as a basis for all European business at Antwerp in Belgium, in much the same way as the price of oil is the basis for things now. So how things change, and you wouldn't want to put any oil on your morning eggs and bacon, I don't think, but it was pepper at one time. Yes, it was. You're listening to KHOY. This is the Donalana Kitchen. We have archives. You can listen to us anytime. And recipes. You can find that ground cherry pie recipe at www.khoifm.org. Yeah. Find us there. You can go to the Donalana, go to the talk session, go to the Donalana show, and we've got archives, we've got recipes, and you can find a picture of us and everything. Yes. We're going to have a little music here, and this music is called Picking the Berries. Welcome back. We're talking about fall. We're talking about fall foods. And that was a little tune from one of my favorite dance bands. A band is called Notorious, and that was called Picking the Berries. Berry season's kind of over with the frost here, but There's still time for apples, and if you got the apples off the tree, they're probably in a cooler someplace. Visit yourself an orchard and get some apple pies made. I kind of feel behind the clock here. I haven't made a decent apple pie yet, and it's time. It's time. Better yet, a combination apple and ground cherry pie. I think I'll do that.
Or apple crisp.
Oh, apple crisp. Oh, I like yes. that, too. I like
For
that,
the
too.
Lazy pie maker.
Another fall treat, and it's kind of a rare thing nowadays. Chestnuts that you in Winter's Kitchen book, Donna. There's a whole chapter on chestnuts.
And it's one of our sad stories. So until the mid-1900s, American chestnut trees filled our forests from Georgia to Canada, stretching west through Ohio to southern Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa. One out of every four hardwood trees in America was a chestnut. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
Parks and town commons feature chestnut trees that widen to 8 to 10 feet in diameter. They're big. Remember the under the budding chestnut tree, the village smithy stands.
He does. I remember that.
Well, then about in the middle of the 1900s, they started all dying because some fancy gardeners on the East Coast imported some exotic chestnut trees for their private gardens, and with it they brought a fungus from the Asian chestnut trees.
That's where it came from.
From that little, carrying in a few chestnut trees from another continent, decimated the American chestnuts. So for a long time, we didn't have chestnuts. So now they've begun breeding. I mean, because it's not considered a major agricultural staple, but it used to be. Because it was a native food choice. Pioneers ate them. People lived on them. They were called the bread tree because they provide so much. Mm-hmm. And the American chestnuts have large, usually more than an inch and a half in diameter. The nuts are just huge. So these new Asian varieties are much smaller. However, we've reached the point where we've bred them to grow here. You can now once again find chestnuts mm-hmm. in some markets, and this is the season, and they are much smaller. But they're still chestnuts, thank goodness.
They are still great. There's farmers that are on the eastern side of Iowa at a place called Red Fern Farm.
Yes.
And they are doing their best and also doing a great job.
And it's a U-pick. He says,
chestnut place.
I said, how are you picking them? He said, I don't pick them. I just let, apparently there's a bunch of communities of Bohemian or people with Bohemian ancestry who actually come down en masse and pick the chestnuts.
Oh, great.
They're smart, I'll tell you.
Great. Let them in to control graze the area, and that's good. That's wonderful. Chestnuts. There, you can find chestnuts every now and then. Some of them were planted as ornamentals, and we happen to...
They're not the same. I have a buckeye tree. You don't eat the buckeyes.
No.
Okay.
But if you find ones that are real chestnuts, and again, they're not very big, but they're good. I've got a little bit of information to share here from the English writer and food writer Nigel Slater from a book called The Kitchen Diary.
Because there's still, yeah. I mean, I know at least in France there are still lots of chestnut trees, and they are gorgeous. They bloom in early July, kind of that, and they're beautiful. They smell good. Mm-hmm. And then they produce nuts.
Yeah, the tradition of chestnuts roasting on an open fire, a very English sort of thing. And Nigel Slater is an English writer, I mentioned, and he writes a little paragraph here about chestnuts. His book is set up by chapter. So we're into the winter.
Seasonal chapters.
The chestnuts that are cooked over coals in the street are not living up to the promise of their nutty charcoal-edged aroma. At home, they are worth taking the trouble with, by which I mean soak in boiling water, peel, and scrupulously defuzz. It takes an age, but the canned varieties lack the sweet nuttiness of the fresh. The delectable and hideously expensive marron glacé are a different matter altogether. I roast my peeled nuts in a dry frying pan, letting them color deeply before salting gingerly and offering them warm.
Oh, that's a good technique.
With pre-dinner drinks. The wonderful thing is that everyone thinks you've gone to so much trouble.
Well, you have, actually.
And he says, yes. The truth is, you have.
Yeah.
They are a fuss, but they are worth it. Yes, they are.
Well, the marron glacé, that's a classic French candy. And actually, when we still had Tomoko here in Iowa, she tried making them one year. You probably boil them the way he does and get all of the two outer layers off of them. Then you boil them in sugar until the sugar is like absorbed and it's they're super sweet.
Oh, they're wonderful to start with and just a little sugar on.
And there are French products also, chestnut purees that are really good in desserts, all kinds of lazy things that you can do just to buy them.
But you can't.
But there's nothing like the fresh roast.
My husband Joe did come home with some chestnuts, small chestnuts that he happened to find from a friend. And
Here locally.
And guess what? He went to the trouble of getting the good insides out, and he got on the internet, well, all good things you find there. He boiled it in sugar and milk. And then, now you had to boil it for a long time to get it soft, and then food processor, and you end up with this lovely
paste. The puree.
Oh, and my.
I think he mentioned he put a little bit of vanilla in it, which is what's in the canned stuff. Of course, the homemade. I did have a bite of Joe's chestnut puree. It was exquisite.
So think of chestnuts and actually all kind of nuts this time of year.
Well, the easy thing to do that's not terribly tedious is I just slam a knife into them because you've got to break the skin before you put them in the oven. Otherwise, they explode all over the place.
Do not put them in the oven without at least poking a good size slit into the or breaking them in half because they explode. Yes, we did it. We did a pan full and we forgot one. And yes,
it exploded.
It did sound like, you know, it just sets you back quite a bit there. That's part of the joy of it.
Yeah, I just put them in a dry cast iron skillet once I've whacked them with a knife and broken that skin. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they're kind of small. So you put them on a fairly high heat. And when you feel like it, like maybe 10 minutes or so, I pull one out and open it up and try it and see if it's reached that kind of mealy, toasty consistency. If you go too long, they do get hard. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If they still taste a little bit green and not sweet and delicious, you know they're not ready yet.
Mm-hmm. A good taste for fall. Yes, we've been talking about fall tastes. We talk about a book called The Winter's Kitchen by Beth Dooley. We talked about a book called The Kitchen Diaries by Nigel Slater. There's some upcoming things here. At the Alluvial Brewing Company this Friday, there's music, barbecue, and beer. That's at the Alluvial Brewing Company. Beer, barbecue. That sounds good. That's Friday, October 19th. And October 17th, coming up this week, there is a chicken and noodle dinner at the Mackey Methodist Church, and they're having a bazaar over there. Mackey is a unincorporated little town in Boone. You're going to have to Google it to find it. But think of fall things. That's a chicken and noodle dinner at the Mackey Methodist Church Bazaar.
Do you know? Does that mean they make the homemade noodles the way my grandmother used to make them?
I don't know, but it might be worth checking it out. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We had music today by the band Notorious. Fiddler Eden McAdams, Summer, Larry Younger, Sam Bartlett, Mark Helensberg. Notorious, yes. Listen to the Donalana Kitchen on KHOY, live Tuesday at noon. It's repeated 7 o'clock in the evening. Or go to khoifm.org for streaming, download, share this anytime you can listen to us. Thank you for your support. Your support is what makes community radio happen. we are all in this together. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We've had excellent engineering, as always, by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.